Possibility means you have a chance.
Passion opens the door to all possibilities.
When I feel like anything's possible, I feel kind of giddy.
I want to be an astronaut,
an artist,
an actress.
To visit another country.
All I need is a backpack and a pair of shoes and I'll find a way.
That I'm able to do anything I set my mind to.
I've never felt like more things are possible than right now.
In the right shoes, anything's possible.
DSW, countless shoes at bragworthy prices. Imagine the possibilities.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Professor Eric Klein. His new book is a sequel to The Original Genius, 1177 BC, the year civilization collapsed, dated. This is the Bronze Age, ending in a series of catastrophes, but it's about to introduce the Iron Age. The way to think about this in terms of literature is the Odyssey and the Iliad are the Bronze Age. The Iron Age that follows looks a whole lot like the Old Testament. So right now we're going to go to Israel at the time and the Israelites via Egypt. Professor, there are lessons to be learned about how some of the Big Eight, Big Seven, Big Six, the global traders of 1300 BC, how the ones succeeded and the ones that didn't. Egypt had a series of rulers. From Ramses III, I believe he was murdered by his wife and his son, or her son, to Ramses XI. And this is the 22nd dynasty. What do we find in there that tells us the catastrophes of 1177 is wearing him down? What's in there?
So in the aftermath of the collapse, and Ramses III is the one who defeats the sea peoples that we've mentioned in 1177, but he is then, as you just mentioned, assassinated apparently by his wife and son, a minor wife, and his mummy has been found with his throat slashed. So after him, there's a series of additional pharaohs that actually 19th, 20th into the 21st and onward in terms of dynasties. And we wind up with Egypt not doing so well, if I could put it that way. They do manage to survive, but they are merely coping in the aftermath of the collapse rather than transforming or even adapting. They are merely coping, and we find ourselves in the centuries after the collapse in Egypt in what is known as the Third Intermediate Period, which is a time of, shall we say, anarchy and chaos, such that at one point we've got no fewer than three or even four different people calling themselves pharaoh in different regions of Egypt. So the upshot for us is that Egypt, which had been one of the major players on the international stage, supplying gold, for instance, to most of the other great powers, Egypt now retreats to a certain extent from that international stage and is busy coping at home with their own problems, including a bit of a delayed reaction to the drought that had hit everyone earlier. It looks like Egypt was saved for a little bit because of the Nile, but then lack of rainfall up in the Ethiopian highlands eventually subjects even Egypt to the drought as well. So they, I would say, almost muddle through these centuries after the collapse with a couple of high points, a couple of pharaohs like Sheshonq, who may be Shishak of the Bible, do provide some high points. But overall, the Egyptians don't fare as well as, say, the Assyrians did.
I'm glad you mentioned the Bible, because this is a lesson that I take from this, that Egypt, peak Egypt is past, and they're coping, as you say, correctly. But that at the same time, there are opportunities here, and one of the opportunities is people to emerge from the highlands. We speculate, did the Israelites come from the highlands? Did they come from migration? Did they come from the sea peoples? Were they part of the Philistines? Probably not. Were they brought in and revolt, as the Bible tells us? And I'm very pleased that so many of the citations that archaeology uses are out of the Old Testament. And I take it that many of the names in the Old Testament, the Bible, are now considered to be guideposts for archaeology and no longer seen as literary. Is that correct, Professor?
Mm. Yes, especially in the first millennium BC, what we get, which we don't really have back in the second millennium, the time of the patriarchs and even down to Moses, where we don't have what we call extra-biblical records, that is, inscriptions apart from the Hebrew Bible. Now, in the first millennium, especially with Assyrian records, we get people mentioned like Ahab, king of Israel, Omri, Jehu. We get these figures now mentioned outside the Bible, which scholars want as corroboration, right? Me personally, I like three separate lines of evidence. So if we have somebody mentioned in the Bible and mentioned in an Assyrian inscription, and we have archaeological evidence for something that's been attested in their reign, then I'm good to go. And so we do get that now in the first millennium. But even if we go back for a second to the collapse and the whole question of Egypt and the Israelites and what happened, there we get into the questions of the Exodus. You know, did it happen? And if so, when did it happen? And, you know, this is a question on which archaeologists are still divided. And then the question of the Israelite conquest of Canaan. Because even in the Bible itself, you know, the book of Judges versus the book of Joshua, one says that when the Israelites come in, it's a genocide of the Canaanites that had been there. And the other book says, no, it was more of a peaceful assimilation and that they lived together side by side. So this also comes to one of the questions that I ask in the sequel. What happened to the southern Canaanites in what is now, say, Sinai? And that region, which the Egyptians have been in control of up until the collapse. And where were the Israelites? There are some archaeologists that think the Israelites were already in the land of Canaan and were up in the highlands, in which case, after the collapse, they may have simply come down from the highlands and have transformed. They would be an example of a successful transformation. But if the Israelites come in as, say, part of the Exodus, taking advantage of the collapse, then they're simply migrating into the region, in which case they're not really transforming at all. They're newcomers. And we have the same thing with the Edomites and the Moabites and the Ammonites. Big discussions among the academic scholars, are these new people coming into the region taking advantage of the power vacuum, or are they people that had already been there and kind of invisible, like nomads during the late Bronze Age, and now they settle down? So these are ongoing questions that we're investigating, which to my mind makes the whole period even more interesting. But it does show that the collapse at the end of the late Bronze Age allows these new, smaller kingdoms and city-states like Israel, like Judah, like Edom, like Moab, it allows them to flourish where they hadn't been able to flourish before, since they would have been in the shadow of the larger empires. So all of this is ongoing research. I do not profess to answer anything. I am simply alerting the public as to the ongoing discussions, and frankly, I think how fascinating they are.
Three cities you name, Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Gaza. I've been to Ashkelon, I've been to Gaza. It's in the news all the time. It's a crossroads. It always has been in the Levant. Are the Philistines the sea people? And were the Philistines in those three cities? It's the question that comes to me after reading your book.
Yes. First of all, the Philistines are in those three cities, plus two more. They're also in the site of Ekron, which is Tel Mikna, and they're in the site of Gath, which is Tel Safi. And four of the five have been excavated. Gaza has never been excavated, and who knows if it will be now or if it's even still there. But these are the five cities of the Philistines. The Bible calls them the Pentapolis. And so we've got all of those. And in fact, very interesting. Let me back up for a second. The Philistines are definitely part of the sea peoples. They are probably the group that the Egyptians call the Peleset. So the Peleset would be the Philistines. We've been able to identify their pottery and various other cultural items like their architecture and such for more than 100 years now. And most recently in the city of Ashkelon, a couple of young children, their bodies were excavated. They are not Sea Peoples themselves. They're from about 100 years later. But their grandparents were probably Pelesset because the DNA that was extracted and studied from these four little kids show that they are partly local Canaanite and partly other. And the computer models indicate the other is most likely Crete or Sardinia or Spain, which is all places that we have suggested the Philistines might have come from. So these four little kids are the descendants of part of the original Sea Peoples, which is very exciting.
The book is After 1177 BC, The Survival of Civilizations. We're going to go to the winners next. Eric Klein, I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
There's a time and a place for Filet-O-Fish, but breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.